humans have damaged the environment perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Juan Carlos Rodriguez and his wife run a sloth rescue center in the lush outskirts of the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. They have so far saved over 45 sloths. The couple decided to start helping the furry mammals last year after running into a sloth that had been badly injured. They saved him and called him Chewie after a character in the popular Star Wars franchise. Juan and his wife are now alone in their life-saving journey. are not alone in their life-saving journey, as their vet friends also help them with services and donations. The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted lives all around the world, but it's important to try to stay fit for humans and animals alike. Penguins in an open zoo in Thailand have been keeping their daily routines, although no visitors are allowed due to COVID-19 restrictions. They are regularly taken out of their air-conditioned enclosure so they can enjoy a walk or swim. The 41 flightless birds consume nearly 25 kilograms of fresh fish each day. The cute animals at the zoo are aged from 1 month to 18 years old.
South Korean medical workers manning drive-through coronavirus testing centers have a new way to cool off and rest amid hot summer days, recovery buses. The medical workers are now able to enjoy their breaks at these buses, which are equipped with air conditioning, cold water, and snacks. The workers are allowed to take off their protective suits that trap heat and create an environment difficult to tolerate. Some of the buses also have shower booths and bunk beds to help the medical workers deal with their hard work. They say the buses are refreshing.
I almost feel like I'm stuck in a heat dome, like in a car with the air conditioner off in the middle of summer. It's so hot that it's even hard to breathe. But when I come here during the break time and rest in a much cooler and more pleasant environment like an igloo, I can recharge and work cheerfully in the afternoon.
These buses were first designed and used as resting places for Korean police officers and firefighters. Now, 22 of them are deployed to testing centers across the country. The government is considering deploying more recovery buses amid rising temperature and a new wave of coronavirus infections.
An aquarium in the French capital, Paris, is celebrating the birth of a baby black-tip shark. The female shark is 55 centimeters long and weighs 560 grams. She's currently quarantined in a small pond so she wouldn't come under attack by adult sharks. Officials at the aquarium say she'll be ready to swim amongst other sharks in 3 to 4 months. She was born last week at the aquarium, an event the caretakers say is very rare.
It's a rare event for us, which hadn't happened here for the past 5 years. The birth is quite rare in aquariums and in captivity in general. In fact, there are often embryos that won't survive, or they're sometimes stillborn. That's what makes it a rare event, which also occurs at night. We had the chance to observe it during the day, which allowed us to intervene very quickly and were able to recover the little one.
The International Union for the Conservation of Nature has designated black-tip sharks as a vulnerable species. It's particularly poached in some countries for their distinctive fins. The marvelous creatures have a torpedo-shaped body and often spin out of water while eating. They have specialized cells in their snouts that detect the electric current of nearby prey.
Cats are notoriously volatile animals, as we all know. One moment they are purring for your attention, and the next they can't stand being touched. Now, a Canadian firm has come up with an app that can help you better understand your feline friends. The app is called Tabby and works with artificial intelligence. The AI's algorithm was trained at a clinic in the city of Calgary. The developers of Tabaly hope their product can be useful for novice cat owners and vets alike. The app can also help monitor the health of cats. Tabaly's developer explains how the app functions.
It uses artificial intelligence, so specifically machine learning, and it's coupled with the feline grimace scale. And what the feline grimace scale is, it's a way for humans to be able to determine if a cat is in pain or not based on the ear positioning, the eye positioning, the muzzle, whiskers, things like that. And so we were able to train a machine using machine learning and a series of images to be able to make that determination. So if you're somebody who has a cat but you don't have that training, you can just use the app and it can help you determine this, how your cat is doing.
Sounds very useful. The Tabaly is not perfect though and runs into problems when trying to decipher the mood of black cats. Despite the hiccups, the developers say the program will get better at doing its task as its artificial intelligence develops through practice.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Muharram Special. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said, Hussein has a position which he will achieve through martyrdom, and he has lovers whom he will intercede while his intercession will be accepted. And certainly, Mahdi is from Hussein's progeny. Good for the lovers of Hussein as they are among the victorious on the day of resurrection. We are in the days of mourning for Imam Hussein, peace upon him, whose movement and goal has gone beyond generations and lands. Muhammad Ali Jinnah, late leader of Pakistan, said, No example of courage has been found in the world better than what Hussein demonstrated. In my view, all Muslims should follow the model of this martyr who sacrificed himself in Iraq. Gandhi, the leader of India, also said, I learned the lesson of liberating my nation from the school of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, used to put his grandsons, Hassan and Hussein, peace upon them, over his shoulders while caressing them and reciting poems for them. Sometimes the Prophet was delivering a sermon at the mosque, but as soon as he saw Hassan and Hussein, he would descend from the minbar or the pulpit to embrace them and kiss them. These behaviors were done to show his love to his grandsons as his successors after their father, Imam Ali, peace upon him. Once Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, left the gathering that he had been invited to. He saw Hussein playing with children. He went to Hussein, opened his arms to hug Hussein. Imam Hussein would run here and there while the messenger of God would smile so that he hugged him. Then the Prophet took Hussein's head and kissed his face. Then he told the onlookers, "Hussein is from me and I am from Hussein. God loves he who loves Hussein." This is an authentic hadith which has been narrated by both Shia and Sunni scholars. One day Hussein, peace upon him, was in the Prophet's arms and the Prophet was making him smile. Aisha, one of the Prophet's wives, said, "Oh, God's messenger, why do you love him so much?" The Prophet answered, "How can I not love him while he is the fruit of my heart and the apple of my eyes? But my ummah will kill him. Anyone who visits him after his martyrdom, God will grant him the reward of my hajj to him." One day Hussein, peace upon him, came to the Prophet while the latter said loudly, "Welcome, O the ornament of the heavens and the earth." One man from among the audience asked the Prophet if there is another ornament of the heavens and the earth except the Prophet, to which the Prophet answered, "Swear by the one who chose me as messenger that Hussein, son of Ali, is known in the heavens more than on the earth. His name has been written on the divine throne as follows. Certainly, Hussein is the beacon of guidance and the ark of salvation." Both Shia and Sunni scholars have narrated from Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari that he said, "I heard several times the noble Prophet as saying, 'He who likes to look at the master of youth in paradise and know him should look at Hussein, son of Ali.'" Imam Hussein, peace upon him, was around 7 years when his beloved grandfather, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, passed away. But what we can find in history is the fact that the Prophet had spoken a lot about the news of his martyrdom. Imam Baqir, peace upon him, says, "The Prophet used to draw Hussein close to himself and tell Imam Ali, peace upon him, 'Keep Hussein.' He kissed his body while crying. Hussein asked, 'Grandfather, why are you crying?' The Prophet would answer, 'Dear son, I am kissing the places of swords and crying.'" It has also been narrated that once the Messenger of Mercy was at Umm Salama's home. The young Imam Hussein came to him. Umm Salama rushed to see that Hussein is on the Prophet's chest while the latter is crying and showing something in his hand. The Prophet said, "Umm Salama, Gabriel told me that this grandson of me will be killed And he brought me some of his tomb soil. This is the soil of that place. When it turns to blood, my Hussein will be killed. Umm Salama said, "O God's messenger, ask God to remove this catastrophe." The Prophet said, "God has revealed to me that Hussein has a position which he will achieve through martyrdom, and he has lovers whom he will intercede while his intercession will be accepted. And certainly, Mahdi is from Hussein's progeny. Good for the lovers of Hussein, as they are among the victorious on the day of resurrection." The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. The program aims to discuss the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. As usual, we will try to explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at Kashmir, 2 years after the Indian government revoked the so-called semi-autonomy that had been guaranteed in the Indian constitution. And we shall talk about the mourning of Muharram across the subcontinental nations to commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad.
In early August 2019, India revoked nearly all of Article 370 in the Constitution, which means the government stripped Jammu and Kashmir, as is called by New Delhi, of a so-called semi-autonomy that had been guaranteed in the Indian Constitution. At the time, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP-led government tried to justify the move as a measure towards stability and economic prosperity for the region. 2 years have passed, but how has the revocation of Article 370 changed the political and security situation in the valley?
Once called heaven on earth, Kashmir is now among the most dangerous flashpoints of the world, sandwiched between Pakistan and India, turning it into hell with rising militarization and militancy. The Muslim-majority Himalayan region is held by India and Pakistan in parts, but claimed by both in full, except for a small sliver that is controlled by China. There are Indian-administered and Pakistani-administered Kashmir, but none of the two governments nor the residents can live with the status quo. While leaving the subcontinent, the British colonialists enabled a division of country on religious grounds, with the Muslim-dominated regions becoming a part of Pakistan and others staying a part of India. As per the partition formula, Kashmir could have gone to Pakistan, as was expected by the Pakistani leadership. But the Hindu king was not ready to make an immediate decision and signed a standstill agreement with Pakistan, presumably to keep the flow of trade, communication, and travel.
The Muslim-majority mountainous valley has been a center of conflicts and even wars between the two nuclear-armed neighbors since the 1947 partition of British India. For decades, the uneasy stalemate has prevailed, broken by occasional military incursions, militant attacks, and police crackdowns. However, Modi's move to integrate Kashmir into India have started widespread uncertainties for the inhabitants of the region, who have seen decades of protests and crackdowns.
Over the last few decades, successive Indian governments tried to mute the voice of popular politicians in Kashmir, while an uprising continued in favor of independence. This has claimed thousands of lives and continues to make the territory a hotbed of militancy with no sight of resolution, as neither side is willing to sit down for talks and deliberate on the voice of the people. Despite efforts by the United Nations or other such organizations to mediate the Kashmir dispute, India and Pakistan continue to administer or occupy their portions of the former princely territory while seeking to get full control of it. Troops on both sides of the so-called line of control regularly fire volleys at each other, but there may be more unexpected developments following New Delhi's move, about which Islamabad said it would exercise all possible options to counter the illegal steps. Since 2019, the Indian government has altered property rights of locals, triggering widespread suspicion among locals that the new laws are part of Modi's scheme to change the demography of India's Muslim-majority region. Some believe that the government may be eyeing building Hindu settlements or other ways to promote right-wing Hindutva ideas in a bid to change the Muslim character of the Himalayan region. New Delhi had apparently given an initial permission, which was later revoked, for annual Muharram processions in Kashmir's summer capital, Srinagar. Activists in Kashmir saw it as a mischievous move by the nationalist Hindu government in New Delhi to stoke the flames of sectarianism in Kashmir Valley.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Sayed Zafar Mehdi, journalist and analyst. First of all, welcome to the program. Mr. Mehdi, on the 5th of August 2019, India revoked nearly all of Article 370 in the Constitution, stripping Jammu and Kashmir of semi-autonomy it had been guaranteed in the Indian Constitution. Now, could you tell us how the revocation of Article 370 has changed the political and security situation in the valley, and for good or the bad?
Well, the best reflection of the situation in Kashmir 2 years down the line are those desolate streets manned by Indian soldiers, the businesses that have suffered losses worth billions of dollars, families who are running around seeking justice for their young children who are framed under draconian laws like Public Safety Act, political leaders and activists who continue to be under house arrest. That's how political and social situation in Kashmir has changed in Kashmir in these 2 years. The abrogation of Article 370, which gives special status to the disputed region of Kashmir under the Indian Constitution, has compounded the misery of Kashmiris, brought more persecution, and snatched their most fundamental human rights. Why I say more is because it's been a long struggle against the military occupation and for freedom with dignity. When we look at a larger picture, this move doesn't count much because the struggle in Kashmir is for the larger goal. But this latest illegal move 2 years ago has only exposed the Indian government's hidden agenda in Kashmir, which is to change the demography, the Muslim majority character of the state on the model of Palestine. The idea behind this move, choreographed by the nationalist Hindu movement, Hindu government in New Delhi, was to integrate the disputed region of Kashmir into the Indian Union against the wishes of the people there. And they went to the extreme to pull it through by imprisoning their own loyal political allies in Kashmir, not to talk of pro-independence leaders, and by making mockery of their own laws. But as we can see now, the move has backfired. Today, not only the general population in Kashmir, but even the mainstream pro-India political leadership feels alienated. They don't see India as their well-wisher anymore. And this is what the abrogation of Article 370 has done. So the writing is on the wall. India may grab the land by force, but it cannot win the hearts and minds of people in Kashmir. It's as simple as that.
Mr. Mehdi, militant groups have intensified their operations in the last 2 years. Some reports say more and more local young people are being drawn towards these groups that are active in the area since India revoked the special status for Kashmir. How do you assess the threat?
Well, the insurgency against the Indian rule in Kashmir dates back to the late 1980s. Many militant groups have been active in the valley, in the Kashmir Valley, for the past three decades, fighting the Indian forces. But in recent years, there has been a remarkable shift, especially since the killing of a young militant commander, Burhan Wani, in 2016. There's more local youth joining this movement, and notably, most of these have been educated with promising future ahead of them. But they choose to take up arms because they felt there was no option, no other option. The resistance movement becoming homegrown, becoming indigenous, is a fact acknowledged today by the radical Indian voices too. Indian Prime Minister Modi justified his decision of abrogating Article 370, the special status to Kashmir, 2 years ago, saying it was stoking militancy. But if you look at the records from 2019, these 2 years, the militancy has not only carried on, but it has intensified, even as counterinsurgency operations have also gained pace. According to some reports, official reports, around 2,200 militants are presently active in Kashmir, and majority of them are locals. And in the last 6 months alone, more than 880 militants, as per the official record, have taken up arms against the Indian rule in Kashmir. So numbers surely don't lie. While I would stop short of attributing this surge in militancy to the August 5 decision taken by the Indian government, because the ultimate goal of these fighters is not reinstatement of Kashmir's special status under the Indian constitution or even statehood. The goal here is freedom from the Indian military occupation. Everyone who knows Kashmir can tell you this thing. But yes, the attempt to dilute the disputed nature of Kashmir, the and attempt to integrate the state in the Indian Union, has definitely provoked the Kashmir's indigenous militant outfits.
Thank you, Mr. Mehdi. Now let's take a break and look how the global media has covered the anniversary of the Article 370 revocation by the Indian government.
The administration of Prime Minister Narendra Modi revoked Article 370 of the Indian Constitution, a 70-year-old provision that had given autonomy to the state of Jammu and Kashmir. The government also introduced a bill to strip the region of statehood and divide it into two parts, both under direct control of the central government. But Mr. Modi, a Hindu nationalist, has campaigned for re-election in part by stoking patriotic fervor against Pakistan. He promised the full integration of Kashmir, a cause which his party has championed for decades, and now he is delivering on that pledge. The controversial move by Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government unleashed widespread unrest and was followed by an increased deployment of troops in India-administered Kashmir, which was already heavily militarized. A strict security lockdown was imposed that lasted over a year, along with a communications blackout and months-long internet shutdown. During the crackdown, more than 100 Kashmiri politicians were arrested, while thousands of pro-autonomy activists were detained. 2 years later, analysts say Muslims living in India-administered Kashmir continue to fear being disempowered and reduced to second-class citizens. The very nature of the decisions taken on August the 5th was aimed at political disempowerment of one dominant community. That's the primary concern of people here.
Welcome back. Mr. Mehdi, since 2019, the government has altered property rights of locals, triggering widespread suspicion amongst locals that the new laws are part of Modi's scheme to change the demography of India's only Muslim-majority region. Now, my question is, has the government succeeded to promote right-wing Hindutva, and has the Indian government succeeded in creating Hindu settlements there on the model of Palestine in a bid to change the Muslim-majority character of the Himalayan region?
Well, the abrogation of Article 370 to end the special status of Jammu and Kashmir state was a long-standing demand of the Nationalist Hindu Party in Delhi, BJP, which is presently ruling India. One of the main objectives behind this move was to change the Muslim-majority character of the Himalayan region, and by allowing Hindus inland India to come and buy properties in Kashmir Valley. Replicating the Israeli model in Palestine. And Article 370 and Article 35A, which is part of this article, people from outside Kashmir, non-Kashmiris, were not allowed to buy land in Kashmir. But this article, when they revoked this article 2 years ago, everything changed. According to the last census, which was in 2011, the population of entire Jammu and Kashmir state is around 12.5 million, which has increased now. And Muslims comprise around 70% of this population. Since August 5, 2 years ago, 2019, Delhi has unilaterally introduced laws related to law and domicile status, which clearly and emphatically seek to change Kashmir's demography and economically disempower Kashmiris. Scores of Indian Hindus from mainland India have already been given domicile certificates and under this new citizenship law, under which non-Kashmiris are now entitled to jobs and residency in Kashmir, which was otherwise reserved only for the local Kashmiris before this article was revoked. So it's quite clear that what the designs of India's ruling BJP party has in Kashmir, despite all the tall talk about economic progress and social empowerment. So it's clear.
Before we take a break, I would like to thank Mr. Zafar Mehdi for being on the program. Now let's see how people on social media see the situation in Kashmir.
Former Kashmir lawmaker Mohammad Yusuf Tarigami says the abrogation of Article 370 by New Delhi delegitimized the mainstream political space in Kashmir. He was one of the senior pro-India politicians put under house arrest on August 5, 2019. Another tweet is by Satindra Kulkarni. That's an Indian politician and newspaper columnist. Those who believe that measures taken on August 5, 2019 solved the Kashmir issue have fallen victim to propaganda. He asserts that Kashmiris feel hurt, humiliated and betrayed. P. Chidambaram calls the revocation of Article 370 in Kashmir an unconstitutional coup and the desecration of democracy, while expressing solidarity with the people of the troubled state.
Every year, on the early days of Muharram, a great number of Muslims and non-Muslims across the world mark the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam and the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon them. Mourners take to the streets for rituals during the first 10 days of the Islamic lunar month to pay their respect and express the unison amongst all Muslim communities in the love for Imam Hussein.
Every year, Shia Muslims, along with a lot of other people around the world, hold mourning rituals during the first 10 days of the Islamic lunar month of Muharram. The mourning ceremonies for Imam Hussein and his companions reach their peak on the 9th day of Muharram, or Taswa, and the 10th day, or Ashura. Ashura marks the martyrdom anniversary of Hussein ibn Ali, Hazrat Imam Hussein, who was martyred in the Battle of Karbala in October 680 AD, or Muharram in 61 AH, nearly 14 centuries ago. The accounts of his heartbreaking martyrdom sent shockwaves through the Muslim world as he was widely seen as a hero who sacrificed his life to challenge the corrupt ruler, Yazid ibn Muawiyah.
Imam Hussein's message is an iconic message. It's a message that crosses all nationalities, all religions, anyone who has a heart beating in their chest can actually appreciate and understand, because there are many aspects, as I said, you know, the martyrdom of his, you know, 6-month-old baby, Hazrat Ali Azhar, or his son, 18-year-old son, Ali Akbar, being martyred, or his brother, Hazrat Abbas, who, you know, was a commander of the army, or, you know, Imam Hussein's friend, coming to join him when he was in his late 80s. So all kinds of fascinating human angles come out of it. Secondly, of course, you know, the viciousness of Yazid's oppression against this small group of people who were standing against the oppressive regime of that time also resonates very well with the current circumstances of what's happening globally, if you like. That's why, I talked about in the historical sense, but if you look at it in the last 30, 40 years, since the advent of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, where Imam Khomeini actually used the iconography of Karbala to motivate the Iranian masses, similarly, people in the subcontinent and far afield, even in other places, can actually resonate very well that, what is oppression and so on.
Morning of Muharram is an opportunity to unite all Muslims behind the cause of Imam Hussein's uprising against tyranny. In addition to the Indian and Pakistani Muslims, myriads of other ethno-linguistic and religious majorities and minorities of the subcontinent consider Imam Hussein as a symbol of resistance and protest against the oppressive powers.
The people of the subcontinent are no stranger to revolt against imperialism due to their shared history of occupation and exploitation. The Muslim community or any other people who feel oppressed and voiceless can view the mourning of Muharram and Imam Hussein as the great unifier. Imagine what feats of human accomplishment might be possible if India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and the rest of South Asia act as one body towards feasible solutions for other problems of the Islamic population.
This year's Muharram comes at a time when mourning ceremonies are held under many pandemic-related health protocols amid fears of another devastating wave of the coronavirus. Indoor gatherings are prohibited, while mourners were advised to hold the rituals in open areas such as squares and streets, instead of traditional places such as mosques and hussainias.
If you look at India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, the whole population of that big mass of land, which is also in old historical maps called Bar-e-Saghir, meaning a continent in its own right, the population of that region is 1.6 billion, 1.7 billion, out of which about 400 to 500 million are Muslims, 250 million in India, 220 million in Pakistan, and another about 160 odd million in Bangladesh, Muslims I'm talking about. So you're talking about at least half a billion Muslims living in that big landmass. And normally statistics are that between 20 to 25% constitute Shias, if you like. So you're talking about well over 100 million Shias living in the subcontinent, more than Iranian population. And perhaps if you add together the whole of the West Asia, there are more Shias living in the subcontinent than the whole of West Asia. So you can see the numbers are quite huge. So of course, historically, as I said earlier, the impact of Imam Hussein's message has been profound. And of course, historically, a lot of Iranians from Iran during Nadir Shah and subsequently moved to, and I'm not talking about the Parsis who were Zoroastrians who moved to India, but also the followers of the Ahlul Bayt who moved to India over the last 300-400 years. They also brought the custom and the practice of Azadari to the Indian subcontinent. And there are two key places, if you like, in India where the whole Azadari took root. One is Hyderabad Dakkan in the south of India, and the other is Lucknow. These were two princedoms, if you like. Nizam of Hyderabad was a remarkable character, although he came from a Sunni school of thought, but he was a lover of Ahlul Bayt, and he provided a lot of facilities, built a lot of Husseinias, provided educational facilities, and the impact of Azadari was quite profound on the subcontinent.
Members of the mourning congregation stage processions listening to eulogies about Imam Hussein while beating drums as a symbol of remembering the Battle of Karbala. As well as weeping and beating chests, votive cooking, or Nazri, is an integral part of the ceremonies. Nazri foods are served or distributed among the mourners and passers-by.
And that was our episode on the situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir 2 years after the controversial revocation of the so-called semi-autonomous status. We also talked about the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, that are held annually during the first days of Muharram. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
With the United States seemingly returning to waging an active air war in Somalia, AFRICOM's recent press releases should raise concern that it may be backtracking on providing transparent reporting of the impact of its airstrikes. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by David Sternman, writer. This article is published under the heading, Is U.S. Military Backtracking on Airstrikes Transparency? Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. On July 20th, the United States conducted its first strike in Somalia since the Biden administration took office, or at least the first strike acknowledged by the U.S. military's Africa Command, or AFRICOM. For the first 6 months of Biden's term, the previously high pace of U.S. strikes in Somalia, as tracked by New America, seemed to have paused, likely in part due to the administration's review of policies regarding counterterrorism strikes. Since the July 20th strike, AFRICOM has reported two more sets of strikes, one on July 23rd and one in August 1st. With the United States seemingly returning to waging an active air war in Somalia, AFRICOM's recent press releases should raise concern that it may be backtracking on providing transparent reporting of the impact of its strikes. Notably, none of these press releases provide details on the assessed number of casualties or other damage, except to note that AFRICOM assesses no civilians were killed or injured in the strikes. In contrast, prior to the Biden administration taking office, AFRICOM had released 5 press releases acknowledging strikes in Somalia. Of these, all but one reported an assessed death toll for those not believed to be civilians. On January 2, 2021, AFRICOM acknowledged an airstrike in a press release, an updated version of which reads in part, "Current assessments indicate the strike killed 3 and wounded 1 members of Al-Shabaab and destroyed 6 and damaged 1 Al-Shabaab compound buildings." On January 7, 2021, AFRICOM released a statement regarding a strike that reads in part, "Initial assessments indicate the strike killed 5 Al-Shabaab members, including the targeted Al-Shabaab leaders." On January 13, 2021, an African press release included the language, "Initial assessments indicate the strike killed one Ashawa personnel and destroyed one compound." 5 days later, AFRICOM released the only press release of 2021 prior to the Biden administration taking office that did not report an assessed number of non-civilian deaths and injuries. However, it did provide a report on the other battle damage, reading, "Initial assessments indicate the strike destroyed one Ashawa compound." Finally, 2 days before Biden took office, AFRICOM released a statement that read in part, "Initial assessments indicate the strikes killed three Ashabaab operatives." The language recounted above is notably absent from the three strikes under the Biden administration. It is possible that such assessments will be forthcoming in the future and are just delayed by difficulties in conducting the assessment or the need to protect sources. The July 20th press release, for example, stated a battle damage assessment is still pending due to the ongoing engagement between Ashabaab and Somali forces. However, the command's initial assessment is that no civilians were injured or killed as a result of this strike, as the strike targeted known Ashabaab fighters and took place in a remote area. Air Wars, which also tracks U.S. strikes in Somalia, notes, Somali state media claimed that at least 20 Ashabaab fighters were killed in the strike. The July 23rd press release stated in part, "The command's initial assessment is that no civilians were injured or killed given the remote nature of where this engagement occurred," and concluded, "Due to operational security, U.S. Africa Command is unable to release further information at this time." As Air Wars reports, the Somali Ministry of Information stated that the precision strike only destroyed Ashabaab fighters and weapons with zero civilian casualties. However, the August 1st press release provides no such possible explanation for the lack of damage assessment beyond civilian casualties. Meanwhile, a statement from Somalia's information ministry reads in part, "The airstrikes destroyed a large Ashabaab firing position engaging Danab and SNA Somali National Army forces as they approached." Air Wars noted that it has seen no local reports of civilian harm from the strikes covered by the August 1st press release, and that a pro-Ashabaab outlet said that no casualties generally were reported from the strikes. While it is possible that AFRICOM will release more detailed assessments of the impact of these strikes, that there have now been three strikes under the Biden administration with no public description of casualty assessments beyond civilian casualties, is worrisome. This is particularly the case as the military has a tendency to contend that there is no good reason to release body counts of its strikes. Reporting the deaths and injuries American strikes cause, even among those assessed not to be civilians, is important. There are deep moral issues with refusing to let the public see the impact of American strikes. As journalist Spencer Ackerman has recently written, refusing to tally the dead ensured that the work of naming the dead would be minimal, periodic, and incomplete, adding, rendering people into statistics would have been dehumanizing enough, but they were not even statistics. Ackerman correctly identifies the way that only naming the civilian dead also plays into the U.S. government's flawed and often wrong assessments of who is a civilian, hampering efforts to check such conclusions. Mm-hmm. not reporting casualties when they are not reported to be civilians also papers over the ways in which the damage and human pain of American warfare cannot be reduced to legalistic categories. There are real questions regarding how much moral weight can truly be placed on the belligerent civilian distinction when belligerents tend to lack an ability to cause harm to those targeting them remotely. As was the case in the three strikes during the Biden administration, each of which involved airstrikes called in support of Somalia forces advised remotely by U.S. forces who were not on the ground. And finally, it is worth considering how not providing assessments of casualties beyond civilians can warp assessments of the threat posed by terrorist groups. For example, a lack of discussion of the toll of U.S. airstrikes against Daesh helped inflate the perceived number of foreign fighters in Syria and thus presumably the public's fear of Daesh by using a count that could not only grow discussing the extent to which foreign fighters were being killed. There are moral and strategic reasons to be concerned when the apparent lack of detailed assessments of all the casualties in the United States' recent strikes in Somalia. With luck, AFRICOM will release further detail in the coming weeks and months, and the lack of detail can be chalked up to the difficulties of making quick and accurate assessments in the types of strikes seen so far under the Biden administration. But lack of detail so far should give pause. And if the context of recent strikes makes it more difficult to report assessments quickly, that should itself be part of the considerations of the recent re-escalation of U.S. strikes in Somalia.
Economic divide.
Grizzly firm NSO is grappling with the fallout of a vast electronic espionage scandal. Turns out that in spite of many politicians, media personnel, and business executives without their knowledge. Not surprisingly, many people are angry. Hi, I'm Kavitah Wei. In this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at the Pegasus scandal in detail, especially its economic and business aspects, and question whether the company is guilty or is Israel to blame. Well, coming up, what is the software Pegasus, and for what reasons was this software developed? The stated objective is to track terrorists and criminals. And why was it abused? Then we will look at how the Pegasus spyware was sold to dozens of countries like Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, despite claiming it vets its clients based on their human rights track records. And also, finally, we will look at the Israeli spyware industry as a whole, how vast it is, and also take a look at what the economic fallouts are from the unlawful targeting and theft of critical economic intelligence. The fallout from the Pegasus software that is spied on a variety of sectors and demographics, from politicians and business executives, should not really come as a surprise. After all, for people who are familiar with the surveillance industry, Israel is a hub for surveillance technology.
I'm Jonas. I'm the managing director of ISDEF, Israel's largest defense and homeland security exhibition. Been around for more than 10 years, and we just concluded our 8th edition in June in Tel Aviv.
It appears that Israel's decades-long occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, along with its periodic wars, actually provides a laboratory for testing and the fine-tuning of different commodities that are created or different technologies for that purpose. Joining us to break this down further is Varun Lyon. He is a former CIA officer. He's also the author of the book Eyes on Havana, which is a memoir of an American spy betrayed by the CIA. Okay. Well, Varun, welcome. You have the Israeli company NSO that has made a software called Pegasus. You're aware of that, a malware that infects iOS and Android devices to enable operators of the tool to extract messages, photos, emails, record calls even, and secretly activate the microphones and the cameras. Is it safe to conclude then that the purpose of this software is spying or snooping, as some call it, while the claimed purpose was to actually overlook criminals and terrorists?
Well, no, I think those stated reasons by the NSO company are probably the ones that they want people to think are legitimate reasons. But obviously a spyware this sophisticated is one of the best Trojan horse things that ever been developed. And obviously it's being used in a lot of different ways, more ways than we can probably imagine. And obviously it's been used not only to spy on dissidents and journalists and heads of state, but obviously it could have been used also to target its greatest supporter, the United States of America. So it raises a lot of serious questions about who uses it and for what purposes.
Okay, thank you so much for that. That's Varun Lyon, former CIA officer. Well, as you mentioned over there, the biggest customer of the Pegasus software and Israeli software for surveillance is the United States of America. It's time now for our InfoNews section. As you're well aware by now, this is where we take a look at other economic news from around the world. Now, just a note, we look at topics that are considerations for future shows and may not necessarily be the most current news. Okay, first up, Google copyright violations. Google has actually been fined by the EU. It continues to battle EU oversight companies. In this case, it was France's competition watchdog that had fined Google this amount of money. It's a row with media companies about paying them for their content. Next up is EU farmers. The curious case here, from the farmers' point of view, is whether they are reaping the benefits of these trade deals that the EU is making. Now, by the year 2030, 12 countries are expected to be the destination of 13% of the EU agri-food exports and the origin of 34% of the EU agri-food imports. Now, the president of the ICMSA, the Agricultural Service in the Republic of Ireland, has rejected any reports that state EU farmers benefit from these deals. Next up, we go to China, China's millennials. Now, this was of particular interest to us because we made a comparison, or it made a comparison, to American millennials. Said that a typical Chinese millennial makes $22,000 a year but has no student debt and has grown up in an economic boom. Meanwhile, an average American millennial has a student debt of almost double that, and many have opted to live with their parents. A final look, Brazil may be experiencing a huge comeback, a sensational comeback by some regards. With the former president Lula, Inácio Lula da Silva's political rights restored, polls suggest that he would thrash current president Jair Bolsonaro for the upcoming elections. Now, Lula's party's name is the Workers' Party, and you can imagine what that means if it translates into improvements in the economy for Brazil. All right, we're headed for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but please stay right where you are. We'll be right back.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for in-depth section. The surveillance industry is vast, but you would not know it. Israel is actually one of the leading manufacturers of software that surveil on people. But that is nothing compared to how the U.S. is spying on its own citizens and even allies. Well, itself, the software and its function as a spying tool has been blasted many times over by many. Well, just in case you aren't aware how powerful a spying tool it is, Pegasus software, that is, well, here's a reminder, courtesy of The Guardian.
With just a single text, it can bypass your phone's security and install spyware that grants complete access to your device.
It can turn on your microphone.